Well, we began this morning a new series, and I would like us also to begin this evening a new series. And I've entitled this one, The Humiliation and Exaltation of Christ. The Humiliation and Exaltation of Christ. And we shall then be working our way through a very well-known New Testament passage. It's Philippians chapter 2 and verses 5 to 11. God willing, this series too will comprise 5 sessions. And if you do the maths then, 7 verses over 5 sessions, you'll see that we're going to be going fairly slowly, really, by my normal standards at least. When we've gone through Romans or Luke or Genesis 1 to 11 or whatever, we've gone at a reasonable pace. We've taken a fairly good-sized chunk each week. And this series, then, by comparison, is going to be a real case of applying the brakes quite dramatically. But it seems to me that some passages particularly lend themselves to this kind of approach. We must always insist, of course, that the whole Bible is divinely inspired and divinely originated. We must insist on that. And that means then, as Paul spells out in 2 Timothy 3:16, that every Bible passage is useful for teaching, for correction, for rebuking, and for training in righteousness. It means that no Bible passage may be dismissed as being unimportant. But it does not mean that every Bible passage is of precisely the same importance. You know how it is with a novel, that there are some passages, some chapters rather, which are important. And if you were to skip those chapters, then the whole thing would lose something of its impact upon you. But then at the same time, there are other chapters, aren't there, which are absolutely essential, which take you to the very heart of the plot. And if you were to skip those chapters, then the whole thing would actually become quite unintelligible to you. And it's the same with the Bible then. There are important passages and there are essential passages. Ephesians 2 verses 1 to 10 comes in that second category, and that's why we've been going through that quite slowly in our recent Wednesday evenings. And Philippians 2 verses 5 to 11 also comes into that second category, and it's appropriate then, I think, to work through it at quite a slow pace in these coming Sunday evenings. Well, my 5 subheadings then for this series are as follows. First of all, Christ in eternity. Secondly, Christ on earth. Thirdly, Christ at the cross. Fourthly, Christ on the throne. And fifthly, Christ in history. And that means then that our first subheading this evening is Christ in eternity. And we're going to be considering verses 5 and 6 of this passage. And I just want to draw your attention to 4 things. First of all, a problem. A problem. Now, it's a fascinating exercise to take some of the Bible's greatest passages and ask the question, why were these passages written? And often you find that the reasons those great passages were written were actually quite unpleasant, or at best were very banal. So you think of that great passage on the love of God, or rather, sorry, that great passage on love, generally, 1 Corinthians 13. And that passage was written because of the muddle-headed thinking that existed in that Corinthian church, where spectacular spiritual gifts were being made the be-all and the end-all. They were being made the great mark of the elite saints in Corinth, who had left behind all the common and garden ordinary Christians. And that's why Paul had to write that chapter. And he's saying to them there in 1 Corinthians 13, hang on a minute, guys. Whoa, wait a minute. Let's just remind ourselves of the one thing that really matters in the Church of Jesus Christ, and the one thing which tragically is conspicuous mainly by its absence amongst you guys there in Corinth. Or then you think of another great passage, Hebrews 11, that kind of spiritual version of Match of the Day, the edited highlights of the Old Testament. And that passage was written because of the childishness that existed amongst those Hebrew believers. This yearning that they had for a more tangible religion, a more visible religion, a religion characterized by more pomp and ceremony and more external grandeur. And that's why that chapter was written. And the writer there, whoever he is saying to those Hebrews, he's saying, hang on a minute. Let's go back to the most basic definition of faith, that faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. And let's go back to all those great giants of ancient times and see that that was exactly the principle by which they lived their lives. Or you think of that masterly exposition of the Christian gospel, the entire book of Romans. And in my view, the reason that Paul wrote that book of Romans was very mundane. It was simply that he wanted to get straight in his own thinking the precise relationship between Jews and Gentiles within the Christian gospel, because at the time of writing, he was in the process of delivering this cross-cultural monetary gift from Gentile churches in Macedonia and Achaia to the Jewish church in Jerusalem, and he really wanted to iron out there for precisely where he stood on this whole ethnic business. And we could go on with other examples, but it seems to me that Philippians 2 is in the same kind of category. Here again we have a monumental passage which arises out of a very unlikely and even unseemly situation, because there seems to have been a problem in this Philippian church. On the surface level, it was a problem of tension and friction and discord between church members. I suppose this comes across most clearly in chapter 4 and verse 2, where Paul writes, I plead with Euodia and I plead with Syntyche. These are two specific individuals whom he's naming in that Philippian church. I plead with these two women to agree with each other in the Lord. But it's also implied, I think, in chapter 2, verse 14, where Paul writes quite bluntly, do everything without complaining or arguing. It's implied in chapter 2, verse 2. We read it earlier. Make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and purpose. And it's implied also in chapter 1 and verse 27, where Paul writes, whatever happens, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Well, what will that look like? What will it mean when they're conducting themselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ? Then he continues, whether I come and see you or only hear about you in my absence, I will know that you stand firm in one spirit, contending as one man for the faith of the gospel. So on the surface level then, this seems to have been the problem in the church, a problem of tension and friction and a discord between church members. But at a deeper level, I think the problem was something else. At a deeper level, it was a problem of individual pride. It was a problem of people in that church having overinflated ideas of their own importance. It was a problem of people in that church wanting to be recognized, wanting people to know, look, I'm so-and-so. I'm so-and-so who has this gift. and this ability and these achievements under my belt. I'm so-and-so. Look at me. They wanted to be recognized and they wanted to be treated accordingly. They wanted to be treated on the basis of who they were. And so I'm saying then that in this Philippian church there was a problem. And if you like, it was a bit like an iceberg. There was a visible part to it. This tension and friction and discord. Doubtless if you'd gone along to worship gatherings in this church, you'd have noticed that fairly soon. You'd have noticed the people who weren't shaking hands with each other, the people who weren't talking to each other, the people who weren't sitting next to each other. You'd have noticed that. That was fairly visible, that there was this unrest in the church. But that was resting on something deeper, a deeper problem, which was the egotism and the selfish ambition and the me-centeredness of these Philippian believers. Just before we move on, it's interesting to note that there were other problems in this Philippian church. For instance, there seems to a degree at least to have been some external persecution. So we've already read verse 27 of chapter 1, but Paul continues in verse 28, without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. This is a sign to them that they will be destroyed, but that you will be saved, and that by God. For it has been granted to you on behalf of Christ, not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for him, since you are going through the same struggle you saw I had, and now hear that I still have. There seems to have been a degree of external persecution facing these Philippian believers. Not only that, but another problem they were facing was having to live out their Christianity in a society which was downright pagan. So Paul writes in verse 14 and 15 of chapter 2, do everything without complaining or arguing, so that you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault, in a crooked and depraved generation. They were having to live out their Christianity in a generation that was crooked and depraved. So there were other problems facing this Philippian church. But Paul doesn't seem to be half as concerned about those problems as he is about this one. Interestingly, the only other one that he is equally concerned about is the problem of false teaching threatening them. And he really deals with that at some length in chapter 3, particularly the threat to the gospel of justification by grace alone. He's concerned about that. But also then, he's very, very concerned about this disunity in the Philippian church stemming from this underlying pride in people's hearts. That for Paul, more than external persecution and more than surrounding paganism, that for Paul is a potential church killer. The problem of disunity stemming from pride. And I think that's instructive for us, isn't it? What's the greatest threat to my church? What's the greatest threat to the health and the integrity of my church? Is it Richard Dawkins? Probably not. Is it the gay rights lobby? Probably not. Is it Islam? Probably not. What's the greatest threat? Of course, we must engage with those things as appropriate, but what's the greatest threat to the health and integrity of my church? The greatest threat is me, my own heart, my own ego, my own ambitions and aspirations for personal glory and success. That, I think, is how Paul thought. And we all need to be always checking ourselves for that. And if we're praying for the health and prosperity of the church, it starts there, watching and praying about our own hearts, that they're not gripped with this kind of egotism that Paul exposes in his epistle to the Philippians. problem. Secondly, notice an example. An example. Because in verse 5 then, Paul addresses this problem which he has identified in the Philippian church. He addresses it by appealing to the example of Jesus Christ. Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus. This is how you should proceed in this situation where there's disunity stemming from pride. This is how you should proceed. You should follow the example of Jesus. Now, Christ isn't the only example that these Philippians can follow to their good and to their benefit in this situation. For instance, look at chapter 2, verses 19 to 21. I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon, that I also may be cheered when I receive news about you. I have no one else like him who takes a genuine interest in your welfare, for everyone looks out for his own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. And clearly then, he's setting Timothy forth there as something of an example. Here's a man who isn't obsessed with his own interests, who isn't me-centered. Here is a man who is concerned with the interests of others. So Timothy is also a good example for the Philippian believers. Then again, Paul himself is a good example for those Philippians. You look at chapter 1, verses 15 to 18. These, I think, are truly remarkable verses. I won't read them, but just to summarize what's going on there, Paul is saying to these believers in Philippi that there are preachers out there. Preachers who are obsessed with their own preaching careers. Preachers who are obsessed with being considered the best preachers around. And preachers who particularly are obsessed with overtaking me, the Apostle Paul, in the popularity stakes. And these preachers, Paul is saying in those verses, these preachers are having a field day now that I am here cooped up in this jail in Rome. They're taking the opportunity to get into as many church pulpits as they possibly can. They're taking the opportunity to run me down as much as they possibly can. They're taking the opportunity to win the hearts of the churches away from me while I am conveniently out of sight and out of mind. That's what Paul is talking about in verses 15 to 18 of that chapter. But what's really fascinating is that he says what his response is to this. What's his response to this situation? Is he grieved by it? Is his heart being broken by it? No, he basically says, I don't care. I don't care. It doesn't bother me. As long as there's a little bit, at least, of gospel in these men's preaching. As long as there's a little bit, at least, of Jesus Christ in these men's preaching, then it doesn't bother me that in the process they're running me down. And in the process they're slandering me. And in the process they're trying to win hearts away from me and to themselves. I couldn't care less because I don't care about my career and about my reputation and about my image and how people think of me. All I care about is that Jesus Christ and his gospel is proclaimed. And I think then that in those verses, Paul is indirectly setting himself forth then as an example. This remarkable attitude he displays there of humility and self-emptying, self-denial. He's setting himself forth as an example for these Philippians. So they have other examples as well as Jesus Christ. But of course we know from elsewhere, don't we? We know particularly from 1 Corinthians 11 verse 1 that men like Paul and Timothy are only examples to other Christians because they themselves are following Christ's example. Christ, in other words, is the supreme example. Paul and Timothy aren't on the same level as Christ when it comes to their exemplary roles. Christ is the example for Christian living. Now, in many ways, I suppose that is pretty basic stuff, isn't it? It's ABC stuff. We all know about that, don't we? We all know about Christ's exemplary status, that he is an example to us. But it seems to me, and perhaps I'm speaking for myself more than for others, but it seems to me that we often treat this far more casually than we ought. You see, when it comes to salvation, when it comes to our justification, when it comes to our very acceptance before God, we're quite clear, aren't we, about the importance, indeed the all-importance, of the earthly career of Jesus Christ, his incarnation, his life, his death, his resurrection. We're quite clear on the importance of that when it comes to salvation. But when it comes to Christian living, I'm not sure that we always are quite so clear. And often perhaps we tend to just muddle along, being helped variously by this technique and that author and that movement and all the rest of it. And yes, occasionally it strikes us, well, Jesus, he knew the scriptures very well. It'd be a good thing for us to know the scriptures well also. And Jesus prayed a lot. It'd be a good thing for us to pray a lot also. And Jesus forgave his enemies. It'd be a good thing for us to forgive our enemies. And there is that occasional kind of contact with the life of Jesus as an example for us. But it's no more serious, our engagement with the earthly career of Jesus Christ, than that. We don't have this kind of serious sense that Christ's earthly career is vital not only for our salvation, but vital also for its exemplary contribution. And I think Paul would not have recognized that approach. I think Paul was like a young tennis player who wants to be able to play tennis like Peter Sampras. And so what does he do? Well, he amasses this mountain of videos of Pete Sampras playing tennis. And he spends hours and hours and hours watching in the minutest detail footage of Sampras playing. And he studies the way in which Sampras grips his tennis racket. And he studies the way in which Sampras stands on court when he's waiting to receive a service. And he studies the way he tosses the ball when he himself is about to serve. And he studies his precise court positioning at different points in a rally. And he studies the way in which Sampras paces himself throughout a match according to different opponents that he's played. And he studies all the different details of Peter Sampras' tennis. And Paul, I think, was like that when it came to Jesus Christ. He was serious about Christ as an example, not just occasionally reading about Christ doing something, thinking, oh, yeah, that'd be quite good for me to emulate. But no, Christ is my example, and I must therefore get to grips with the way that Christ lived his life on earth. John Stott quotes the Reverend Iskander Jadid, a former Arab Muslim, who once said this, that if all Christians were Christians, that is, Christ-like, there would be no more Islam today. Do we need any greater wake-up call than that for the importance of this that Paul is talking about here in Philippians 2:5? Christ is our example. This is not peripheral Christian theology. We emphasize the atonement that Christ achieved, and that's the main thing, and his example comes just somewhere right at the very bottom of the pile. No, we must make sure we are living with him as our example. Our attitudes must be the same as that of Christ Jesus. Thirdly, a backdrop. Because in verse 6 then, Paul is building up to specifying the precise area in which the Philippians should follow Christ's example in this situation that they're in. But before getting to that, he needs to supply some vital background information. And the vital background information he needs to supply is that which we find at the beginning of verse 6. Who, being in very nature God, but the traditional rendering is the accurate one, who, being in the form of God, dot, dot, dot. That's the background information that we need to get in place before we can understand what Paul is going to say next. That Christ possesses the form of God. Well, we need to ask then, what does that mean? What does it mean when Paul says that Christ possesses the form of God? Well, I think two things need to be said here. First of all, he's talking here about nothing less than full equality with God. He's talking here about nothing less than full equality with God. Because that's made quite clear, isn't it, in the second half of the verse when Paul elaborates by using that very phrase, equality with God. In other words, Paul, in using this phrase, Christ possesses the form of God, he's not simply saying something like Christ has a certain resemblance to God about him. Christ has a certain God-likeness about him. There are certain points of contact between Christ and God. He is perhaps divine in some sense without actually being equal with God. That's not what Paul is saying. There's been a history for 2,000 years of various different groupings, haven't there? Various different sects who have gone down that kind of route, just muddying the waters. They won't actually rule out that Christ is divine in some sense. But they won't go as far as saying Christ is equal with God. I suppose the Jehovah's Witnesses are an obvious grouping in our context today. But make no mistake about it. When Paul says Christ has the form of God, he's not using that instead of saying that Christ is fully God. Because he goes on to say that Christ is equal with God. So he's talking here about full equality with God. And just pause and let that sink in for a moment. That Christ is equal with God. How easily we have this wrong picture, don't we, of the Godhead, this wrong picture of the divine Trinity, of somehow the Father sitting on this particularly exalted throne, and then the Son and the Spirit sitting on slightly lower and lesser thrones on either side of him. That is emphatically, categorically not the biblical picture. The biblical picture is of Father, Son, and Spirit, in fact, seated on one throne. One God, all three persons, absolutely equal, all co-divine, co-eternal, all possessing within equal measure all the attributes and all the prerogatives and all the privileges of deity. We must get this right. Christianity stands or falls with this. If you don't get anything else right, get this right. This is the most basic thing about Christianity. This is the essence of Christianity. Christianity is worshipping Jesus Christ, and you can't do that unless he is equal with God. Our worship is blasphemy if he is not equal with God. But the New Testament's insistence and Paul's insistence here in Philippians 2:6 is that Christ is equal with God. We must keep coming back to that again and again and again. Christ is God. So he's talking about equality with God. But then the second thing to mention here is that he is particularly in this phrase stressing appearance. He's particularly stressing appearance when he says that Christ has the form of God. Perhaps a good way of bringing that out is just to draw your attention to an unrelated verse, but which uses the same word in Mark's Gospel, Mark chapter 16. Mark 16, verse 12. This is in the longer ending of Mark's Gospel, but it doesn't make much difference to us tonight whether we should consider this part of the canon or not. It's just the vocabulary that I'm drawing your attention to. Because in Mark 16, verse 12, the author writes, "Afterwards, Jesus appeared in a different form to two of them while they were walking in the country." So the author here is talking about Jesus' resurrection appearances. And he's saying then that at a different point, Jesus' resurrection appearances took different forms. And clearly then, he's talking about different appearances. He's not saying that Jesus was a different person on these different occasions, but he's saying that Jesus had a different appearance about him in these different resurrection encounters. And that then is the word that Paul uses here in Philippians 2, verse 6. So he is particularly stressing appearance. And I think you see that it goes back to what we've said tonight about what the Philippian problem was. The Philippian problem was this, the underlying problem was this desire to be recognized. I want you to know who I am. I want you to know that I'm so and so. I want to be noticed. I want to be recognized, and I want to be treated accordingly. I want to be treated properly on that basis. And here you see Paul then is pointing to Jesus Christ, and he's saying Jesus Christ has by right that recognition, that he has always had it, that he has the recognition of the angels in heaven, that he has the form of God. When the angels in heaven, when those seraphs we considered this morning, when they turn their eyes from God the Father to look at God the Son, they don't suddenly take the wings away from their eyes and from their feet. They don't suddenly breathe a sigh of relief and relax because Christ's appearance is so much less grand than the Father's appearance. No, Christ has the form of God. His appearance is every bit as grand and as glorious and as splendid and as awesome and as majestic as the Father's is. In his appearance, he is everything that the Father is. He too compels that kind of covering and hiding in the seraphs around the throne. So Paul is saying, look, here's Christ. And he has this recognition. He has the appearance of God, and all the angels in heaven recognize him for being God. And so that's the backdrop that we need to understand. Before, fourthly, we come on to a surprise. A surprise. Because the surprise then, the sting in the tail, is what he says in the last part of verse 6. The NIV has it, who being in the form of God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped. I don't think that's probably the best translation, because grasping equality with God isn't really relevant. He has equality with God, as we've already said. And it's probably best to translate it something like this. He did not consider equality with God a matter of grasping. He did not consider equality with God to be all about grasping. He did not consider grasping to be the essence of equality with God. Because Paul is saying then to these Philippians who so want to be recognized, who are puffing out their chests, they want to be recognized. He's saying, here's this one, and he is by right recognized for being great and glorious and majestic, recognized by all of heaven. And yet look at his mindset. Look at his attitude. He doesn't see that as being something which demands that he insist upon his rights, that demands that he go around saying, look, you better treat me properly, you better recognize me, and you better ascribe honor to me. But Christ doesn't consider equality with God to be about grasping. And the rest of the passage then, which we'll look at in the coming weeks, will unfold just how much he doesn't consider it to be about grasping. And how instead of grasping, he actually considers it to be about the opposite, about renunciation, about relinquishing all his rights. But the point initially in verse 6 is that he didn't consider even this grand status that was his by right, he didn't consider it to be something which excused a grasping mentality, which precipitated a clamoring, grasping mindset. And so I close then with the obvious challenge. Are we like Jesus Christ in this area? I've said already tonight how dangerous our own hearts are when it comes to this matter of egotism, of wanting recognition, wanting to be noticed. And could anything make that appear more ridiculous and more pathetic than this, that the Son of God himself, who is equal with God, and who you would have thought therefore would always be saying, look at me, that even he didn't have that kind of grasping mentality. Even he, the most glorious being that there is, doesn't have that kind of mindset, but he has a humble, self-obscuring, self-disguising, self-concealing attitude, which will take us in the coming weeks to astonishing realms, even death on a cross. Are we like that? Do we have Christ's humility? He was the only great somebody, and yet he had the mindset of a nobody. And here are we, and we are nobodies, and often we have the mindset of somebodies. Let's be like Christ. Let's be humble. And then perhaps we'll be on our way to conforming to that quote of John Stott, or quoting that Arab, that former Arab Muslim, if all Christians were Christians, that is Christ-like, there would be no more Islam today. May God help us. Amen.